KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The homeless mothers who have been occupying a vacant West Oakland house since November are back in court this morning to hear from a judge on their right of possession claim. We'll hear from one of the mothers, as well as from the company who owns the house, and we'll bring you the latest news in the case. But first, we talk about the contributions of black tech pioneers and the current state of diversity in Silicon Valley with NYU professor Charlton McElwain, author of The Internet and Racial Justice from the AfroNet to Black Lives Matter. It's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When NYU Vice Provost Charlton McElwain set out to understand how the Black Lives Matter movement energized broad national support, he found a long tradition of black activists connecting their communities through the Internet. McElwain's new book is called Black Software, and in it he tells the story of the black Internet pioneers from the 1970s onward who used the web to amplify their communities' voices. McElwain joins us now to discuss the book and to share why the stories he uncovered are often excluded from official histories of the Internet. Welcome, Charlton McElwain. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
I guess the place for us to begin is by talking about how you have uncovered a lot of history here, and I commend you for that. A lot of history where the names were not even known of some of these black pioneers in terms of Silicon Valley or what has become Silicon Valley, but really the Internet specifically. And the trajectory, I think it's safe to say, goes, shall we say, from hobbyists and activists and digital organizers of the 70s and 80s to groups like Black Lives Matter.
That's correct. This book started off as a way for me to try to understand and answer the question, where did Black Lives Matter come from? A powerful movement that we all know, fighting for racial justice. And as I began to write the book, I started to look back further and further in history. The more I talked to folks and found folks, my story started to go back further and further in time. And all of those times were discoveries, if you will, or rediscoveries of people that our official histories never really knew. And I think one of the reasons is that when we think about the Internet, when we think about computer technology, our histories are often focused on people that we call inventors and inventors of hardware and software. And that type of focus leads us to white folks, white men generally in lab coats, in computer labs and so forth, and takes us off of the history and attention of people who really made the Internet what it is and made it what we know both today and what we knew it as when it was first birthed to the public in the early 1990s.
And again, I commend you for giving us those stories because they are important stories and they're very human stories in many ways. And I hope we have time to get into some of them. But let's just talk about what you just touched on, which is the Internet made by and for whites for the most part. I mean, according to some research, I'm thinking about somebody like UCLA's Sophia Noble, it is otherizing, I think was her word, non-whites. It was essentially a space, the Internet, which was a white space. And you pretty much corroborated this, I know, in your research. But the algorithms still, to a great extent, favor white perspective, don't they?
That's indeed correct. And colleagues and friends like Dr. Noble and others for a very long time have been pointing out the ways in which when we look at the Internet of 1992, 93, the early web, where people, of course, said, hey, this is a new democratizing space where things like race and gender won't matter because we won't be able to see each other. So there will be no inequality, no discrimination. And from the very beginnings, people pointed that out and said this was patently false. That is, that the default Internet, the default culture of the Internet in 1992, 1993, and so forth was white. And it was othering in both implicit and explicit ways. And that othering continues to this day in new ways and more algorithmic ways that systematically exclude black people, people of color from really organizing and doing things on the internet that serve the best interests of communities of color.
I think, to use your language, it's baked into the search engines by human engineers, and one should never forget that the engineers do have humanity, which often involves prejudice and the like. But there's also a sinister story here that you tell. The committee men, those in federal government and the computing industry, elite science and engineering education institutions conspired to use technology to actually keep Black America docile and in its place.
Absolutely. So, you know, Black software is really two stories in one. That first story is about those unsung heroes, those hidden figures, Black tech pioneers who built an internet that was for Black people, by Black people, and for our interests, beginning in the 70s, 80s, and really on the scene in the 90s. But the other Black software story is that story about the ways that the computer's first principles, we could call it the computer technology's origin story, was built and motivated by the need to curtail and to limit the threat that Black people posed to America's racial order, to the system. In 1960, as Black folks were marching on the streets across the United States fighting for their rights.
Let's talk briefly, if we could, about some of the figures that come to the fore here, whose names have not appeared in histories before, as they should have. We can start maybe with Derrick Brown, who was a Georgia Tech engineering grad student and who really sort of got things rolling in terms of the role of African Americans.
Yeah, Derrick Brown got an engineering degree from Clemson in South Carolina, went to Georgia Tech to get a master's degree in electrical engineering, and while there, decided that, you know, he wanted to do something with this new computing technology. And he had always been someone who said for himself the power of computing was for him not in gaining power, but in distributing knowledge and power to other people in his community. And so one way that he was able to do that, along with and spurred on by the Black Graduate Student Union at Georgia Tech in the early mid-90s, was to build the Universal Black Pages. And what that was Derrick and others looking out on the newly formed, newly open, newly connected web and seeing islands of Black websites that featured Black information, Black news, ways for Black folks to connect for business, for pleasure, for all these reasons, but seeing no way for those sites to be connected. That is, that there was no way that these were navigable. If I wanted to build a neighborhood, let's say, of Black information and Black websites, there was no way to connect them. So a user would simply have to know that a website exists or just happen upon them. And so what Derrick did was to say, let's link all of these sites. And that became his work in that early period that was called the Universal Black Pages, that started really as a community interest, as a hobby, as a service that he later tried to turn into a business, did not work out that way, but was a valiant effort.
And as we said earlier, the trajectory that I alluded to was to use technology increasingly as a tool for change, and we see that in many of the stories that you highlight and that you tell, although to a great extent it's, I think, safe to say that racial sites still go to racial sites and non-racial sites to non-racial sites?
In some respects, and you know, you might be referring to one of the studies I did several years ago that showed that when we look at online traffic navigation patterns, when we look at the way that users move through the online ecosystem, that there is a pattern where folks that are interested in sites that have racialized content, be that imagery and text and video and other kinds of content that are for, by, about, that represent the interests of people of color, that they tend to find their way to other sites like that. And similar for those looking at sites that don't feature racialized content in some way. And so what that tells me is that there still is an interest in folks being able to find each other, to build community, to have a connection in this world that used to be what we call virtual, but now is simply our everyday life.
And if you've just joined us, our guest is Charlton McElwain. He's Vice Provost of Faculty Engagement and Development and Professor of Media Culture and Communication at NYU. He's also the author of a book that we're discussing called Black Software, the Internet, and Racial Justice from the AfroNet to Black Lives Matter. And we do welcome your involvement in the program, so let me tell you how you can be part of the program. You can give us a call right now and join us at 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your thoughts, and comments, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you have to forum@kqed.org. And I was struck, I don't know if you saw it, is it Professor McElwain or Provost McElwain or Charlton? What should I call you?
Charlton is just fine.
All right, Charlton it'll be then. I was struck by an article that some of the listeners and you might have seen in the Sunday New York Times about Twitter, and it was talking about how there's been so much criticism of Twitter, and particularly when we think about the tweets that go out of the Oval Office or the White House, but also how it's been used in some, shall we say, destructive ways. But it talked about, this is an article by Sarah Jackson, who wrote about how Trayvon Martin's name became so well-known because of Twitter, Michael Brown's name and Sandra Bland, and for that matter, Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old kid who was shot by a police officer in Cleveland. And they were saying essentially that, in fact, Tamir Rice is an interesting example because the hashtags were linked to Emmett Till. They were kind of connected. They were actually connected together. So when we think of Black Lives Matter and we think about the Internet today, we're thinking about it really as an example of Twitter as an instrument really of change, and particularly when we're talking about African Americans becoming increasingly aware in ways that they could never have been in the past.
Absolutely. And another friend and colleague, Sarah Jackson, whose article was really spot on, which is, you know, think about the ways that we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, when we look at a platform like Twitter and others that, run the gamut. And sure, when we think about Black folks who organize, activists who congregate, people who use Twitter to find pleasure in their everyday lives and pursuits, on the one hand, and then on the other, we have the rampant trolling and things of that nature. But the fact remains that the world knows about Black Lives Matter in part because of platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, other social media platforms. And so I think rather than thinking about this as either a Twitter is good, Twitter is bad, thinking about what it is good for and really thinking about the ways that groups of people, activists who are interested in racial justice, have found ways to mobilize and utilize the platform to their ends. Does it do everything? No. Does it solve everything? No. Does it do everything that's needed to further a movement? No, but it is good for what it's good for, and that is driving attention, and that is the way that Black Lives Matter activists and others have exploited that platform to great success. It's the reason we know Trayvon Martin. It's the reason we know Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, many other African Americans who unfortunately have been brutalized, killed, at the hands of the U.S. criminal justice system.
Now, here's an opinion apropos what we're talking about. A listener writes, I think the Black people involved in the creation of the Internet would be aghast at being mentioned in the same sentence as the Black Lives Matter movement. You want to comment on that, Charlton?
I don't know if I agree with that necessarily. I think that it manifested in different ways. The technology, the Internet of today is significantly different in many respects than it was in, say, 1992, 1993, or even as existed through the 80s. But I think the underlying thread is that those early users, people who flocked to places like the AfroNet and other online, Black online communities, or news groups or other channels came with an underlying purpose to find some form of community, that is to connect with other folks like themselves, other black folks, other people of color, other folks who had their interests in mind. And it's that community, that connection, the idea that we are all in the same boat, that we are all connected to one another, that we share a linked fate in some respect, that I think drove the technologists and users, black users of the early internet, with those who are users now and those who really mobilized to make things like Black Lives Matter happen.
I just have to tell you that a couple of things that were particularly striking to me in your book were the role historically of black colleges and black universities. I mean, Fisk, Howard, North Carolina A&T, and Wilberforce, so forth. But also how when things began to change from the hobbyists and the digital organizers and activists and so forth, women became more involved. I'm not only talking about Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi, who were the founders, co-founders of Black Lives Matter, but women like Patricia Cullors and Charlene Carruthers. I mean, suddenly women have a central role, which they didn't, of course, in the early years, and that's striking. I'm talking about African-Americans specifically. Let me bring a caller aboard here, and that's Danielle. Danielle, join us.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm just so elated to hear this topic. I just wanted to bring out a segment on 60 Minutes last month where the CEO, Susan, and her last name I probably won't pronounce it wrong, Wojcicki, Susan was on, and they showed her typical Monday meeting, and there was only I didn't see any faces of color in that meeting. It was very troubling to me. I wanted to cry as an African-American woman. I thought that the Silicon Valley was making strides and bringing in more people of color, more African-Americans, more Latinos, but that clearly wasn't evident in what I saw. And I wanted to cry. I thought there was more being done about diversity in the Silicon Valley. And I wanted to talk to Susan. I kept saying, how can I get in touch with her? You know, what can I do to help the younger generations, you know, realize that they need to be in this industry? We are being cut out. I don't know what the underlying problem is, but I feel like if we can talk about that right now, it would be great.
Danielle, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'd like to go again to Charlton McIlwain and get his thoughts about this on Silicon Valley. And still barriers for African Americans? I mean, they have loosened up somewhat, but you don't see that many people of color.
That's very true, and thank you for your question and comment, Danielle. And it's very true. I mean, to the degree that there is some hype by tech companies who talk about diversity, who give lip service to diversifying their industry, nothing has changed. If you look at the official statistics in terms of simply representation, all of those numbers for the vast majority of tech companies have been stagnant for the last decade. And then when we think about other forms of representation, the idea that you don't have people in that room that you observed in the boardroom at tech companies who are really poised to make a difference, to influence the trajectory of these companies and the technologies that are being built, how they're being designed.
Forgive me, Charlton, that's where really the emphasis has to be, in the boardroom and in leadership. But what about the pipelines here? I mean, in terms of changing.
Well, you know, there's always problems with the pipeline, but the tech companies always like to point to that as a scapegoat, when in fact there are many, many, many engineers, coders, people of color who are prepared to fulfill those roles that are simply being overlooked. And I'm not talking about your run-of-the-mill person who learned to code at home or online over the course of a few months. While those folks are certainly important, I'm also talking about folks who have Harvard engineering degrees, things that everyone says is the pinnacle of their credential. And these are folks that go to tech companies and are either driven out or pointed into jobs in PR or marketing or diversity and inclusion, folks who will never have a say in the actual big questions and the big decisions that are being made by those companies.
What about something like the tech exchange, that partnership with Google? Can you comment on that?
Sure. I think it's too early to tell how it's going to turn out, but we have the last 50 years to sort of make a guess, and that guess is to say it probably won't do much of anything. I hope I'm wrong, but 50 years of history tell us that these are tech companies from IBM in the early 60s to many of the others throughout this 50-year period of time who have said over and over, we care about diversity. We believe in affirmative action. We believe in adequate representation of folks of color and marginalized folks in this industry. And from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s to the 90s up through the present, nothing has changed.
As they say, the needle has not moved much at all, in fact, and that's most unfortunate. And I've got a question from a listener. Can you talk about the research that shows internet algorithms are biased in favor of white people, Charlton?
I could talk about them some, and you mentioned my colleague Sophia Noble earlier. I could talk about Rua Benjamin, professor at Princeton University. These are, issues that I think are on many people's minds today, thanks to those folks and others. And it really goes back to two things. When folks build software, one of the first questions you ask is, what are we going to build, for whom, and why? What does it serve? And when you have people in the room building those technologies who have no sense of connection with diverse groups of people, with people of color, when there are not people of color in that room, then you're going to end up with biases that tend to favor folks that are in the room, white folks. And so we can see this in, algorithms from search algorithms and Google that privilege, let's say, businesses that are run by white folks, that are popular, that are highly visited, that receive a lot of traffic, while similar sites that are owned by African Americans or other people of color never appear in search engine results or appear at the bottom where no one is looking.
I got seconds left here, unfortunately, Charlton. Let me get a quick caller in here who has a specific question.
Okay.
OV, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, this is OV, and I just wanted to call attention to your use of the term people of color. 60% of all of the engineers and technical professionals in Silicon Valley are people of color. They're mainly Chinese and Indians. And, of course, when you go up the corporate hierarchy, you find fewer and fewer of them.
Yeah, that is a fact, I think. And your response, Charlton, quickly?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I say people of color to be very broad. I often talk very specifically about African Americans and Latinx as being vastly underrepresented. But I think those are two parts of the same camp.
Good to have you with us. Again, the book is Black Software, and thank you, Charlton. Come back. Stay tuned. Tomorrow on Forum, we'll bring you highlights from our archives, including my September interview with Ibram X. Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. And Forum is looking for changemakers, leaders, innovators, or anyone with a compelling story to tell that you think we should feature on our show. Email your nominations to forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Tell us why they make the Bay Area awesome or unique.